Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
By the power of lyrics.
Nice.
This is the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. Andy continues to explore the world, its cultures, and its music.
Imagine there's no Andy.
It's harder than you think. So, Don, how you doing, my friend?
I'm good. I'm feeling like a master of albums.
Awesome. Yeah. So this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We talk about albums, the album format, how much we love them. And today we've got a really great show for you. We're going to be talking about the power of lyrics in music and in albums. And we're each going to present our choices for a good representation of that. Then we're going to have Don ask us a deep question. We're going to have some shout outs to some albums and album related items that we're digging. And then we're going to spin that wheel of musical discovery to find out what we'll talk about next time. But today,
that's what I'm talking about.
Lyrics in popular music can have a profound impact on listeners' emotions, beliefs, and cultural values. Research shows the combination of words and music activates multiple areas of the brain, making lyrical messages particularly sticky and memorable.
Sticky.
Steamy and sticky. Lyrics can shape thoughts and attitudes across generations, highlighting the importance of being mindful about the lyrical content we consume. Today, both of us will present albums that demonstrate the power of lyrics.
The power.
So, yeah, lyrics definitely are the stickiest of things, I think, within music, because you can have guitars, trumpets, whatever the hell you want, but without some human sentiment to grab onto, sometimes it can be tough to relate to the music. So, yeah, there's a lot, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, and a lot of times there's like one song on an album that's really impactful worldwide. I mean, the Macarena is a powerful lyric.
Not.
What are the lyrics? Hickabucka, diggabucka, diggabucka, digga.
Macarena, just the word Macarena hey, okay. Macarena, that's enough, right? Yes, that's a powerful piece of lyric, but we were looking for something that we could connect to a little more deeply, or that people do, and that was the power I think we were going for. So how'd you do, man? What albums were you considering that didn't quite make the cut?
I think I was always drawn to lyrics. You know, being a big Cure fan, I think Robert Smith of The Cure is definitely one of my favorite lyricists. The album Disintegration is probably the best example of that from 1989. Loss, heartbreak, the decay of relationships, the decay of your aging body and mind. It's a dark album, but beautiful and intense. A slightly more modern example, Death Cab for Cutie. We did the album Plans not too long ago. The follow-up to that, Narrow Stairs, is great. Ben Gibbard is the main vocalist and lyricist from the band. But there's a cool line in the song Kath. She holds a smile like someone would hold a crying child. I think that's a metaphor or an analogy.
Sure.
How about you, dude?
I thought about Bobby Dylan. Of course.
Oh, you mean Zim?
Zim. Robert Zimmerman. Highway 61 Revisited was the album I was closest to. It's a groundbreaking album that blends rock and blues and surreal poetry. And it's that moment when he goes rock and seemingly turned his back on traditional folk music. But it's got the song Like a Rolling Stone, among many others. But the lyrics really delve into themes of rebellion, disillusionment, and societal change. So that was on the top of the list. Mm-hmm. And then just a heart pick, Pearl Jam Versus, which for me meant a lot lyrically back in 93 when it came out. It's a raw, intense album that showcases their more kind of powerful blend of harder edged rock, tackling themes of frustration, freedom, and societal struggles like daughter and animal. And they're poetic. Mm-hmm. You know, Eddie Vedder was very poetic. There was a lot of society stuff and also a lot of backlash and anger, I think, at being a famous person. So.
Seem to recognize your face.
That's the one. I mean, you know.
It's a great song.
Can't find a candle of thought to light your name. Yeah. I mean, that's a great lyric. Yeah, that's good. That's from Elderly Woman Behind the Counter in a Small Town. The title itself is poetry. All right, so why don't we get into our actual choices?
You Choo-choo choose me?
Well, I went with a modern-day poet who's quite well-known these days, Taylor Swift.
Wow.
Well, her most recent album, The Tortured Poets Department, came out in April 2024. We're actually going to talk about the full version of it, The Tortured Poets Department, the anthology. This is a deep dive for us, I think. So we asked for help from Jess from Music Notes with Jess. Let's hear what she had to say.
Hey, album nerds, hosts, and listeners. Thanks for asking my input for Taylor Swift's 11th and 2024 album, The Tortured Poets Department. This is a unique work summing up her past and present relationships. The first 16 tracks allude to breaking up with British actor Joe Alwyn after 7 years, some type of fling with the 1975's alternative frontman Matt Healy, then 15 more tracks extended to The Tortured Poets Department, the anthology, covering 2023's last half of the year, dating Travis Kelce, a Kansas City Chiefs football player. You heard that right. 31 tracks, one album. Oh, and yeah, released within 2 hours digitally.
Thank you, Jess.
Yeah, so 31 tracks, yeah.
I mean, it's a little overwhelming, so getting some help from a subject matter expert is key here.
Yeah, and we'll hear a little more from her in a bit. Let's start off with the first song. This is Fortnite.
I was kind of hoping it was about her playing Fortnite and getting a victory royale.
The royale with cheese?
That's when you win.
Oh, okay. So that track was written with Post Malone, who also appears on the track, and also Jack Antonoff, which is a great name, which, yes, I'm sure I made fun of last time.
You did.
So the lyrics are about a woman's account of how she became a neighbor of an ex-lover who is now married to another woman. She fantasizes about killing the wife. She then finds out her husband is cheating on her, and she fantasizes about killing him. Then in the end, Post Malone, I think, is supposed to be her ex-lover. He sings about escaping to Florida, you know, which comes up later on the album.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a cool, you know, moody track. I don't know. I feel like she might be listening to my album collection because, you know, her recent, the last album, this one, feel kind of new wavy and synth poppy, yeah, and a little dark.
It's a sound that suits her. I mean, I'm not super familiar with her discography. I tried listening to that folk one, mm-hmm, this week as well, and I had checked out part of her early country albums previously. But, you know, Midnight's had similar sounds. I think this does it even more eerily. I think this seems a little more haunted, you know, maybe by the memories of the things she's talking about, but it's more a feeling. And then they're like, I can't name any offhand, but while listening, there'd be little lyrical twists that she made, little things she said that I liked, not necessarily in the context of the song, but just there were nice little lines here and there that kind of gave it some cred, for me to continue to listen, you know?
Yeah, that happened with me too.
It's easy to be dismissive, you know, of this kind of thing.
Did you like it when she said, like, I'm pregnant, no, just kidding, or something?
No, that would not be, that would not be one that gets a gold star, but there were other moments.
All right, so yeah, I mentioned Jack Antonoff. He was in the band Fun. He's been working with her on a lot of her recent stuff, including Midnights, which we talked about before. Seems like the other half of the album is with Aaron Dessner of The National, and here's one written with him. This is called The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived.
If rusting my sparkling summer was the goal, and I don't miss what we have.
Rusting my sparkling summer, that's a good line.
Yeah, yeah, she has a lot of little ones like that.
Apparently so does this guy that she's talking about.
So, you know, this is I guess a breakup song, kind of a diss track, you know, not the only one we'll talk about today, about an unnamed ex-lover. Well, people think it's about Matt Healy of the 1975, but I'm kind of glad I don't know most of the cast of characters that she's singing about. I feel like it's kind of a distraction.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, the lyrics for her fans in particular have more context rooted in her life, and I think that's why her lyrics are powerful, mostly for her fans.
Mm-hmm.
Like people like us, there are some moments I'm not connecting with a whole lot It's a nice lilty sounding album, but I'm not like moved by it. But her fans are so, just as I have been with bands I love, so in the know of everything going on in her life that they can make these connections and feel connected to her. And I think that's part of the magic.
Yeah. Yeah, suddenly in the middle of the song, she starts talking about like espionage. You know, were you sent by someone who wanted me dead? Did you sleep with a gun underneath our bed? Were you writing a book? Were you a sleeper cell spy? In 50 years, will this all be declassified? So maybe she was watching The Americans.
Who knows?
Anyway, so my clickbait headline for the Tortured Poets, I want to say society.
Yes. Captain, my captain.
No matter what anybody tells you, words and ideas can change the world.
Swift offers Blue Light Special in the Tortured Poets department. 31 thoughtful songs on one album.
I think you're going 31 flavors.
Oh, yeah. I picked this just because I know how much this album means to, I mean, particularly like young ladies. And I get the appeal because it does seem introspective. It's about her, you know, so, I mean, she does use metaphors and stuff like that, but it does feel very personal. And I think it's sincere. But yeah, I mean, you're dealing with kind of traditional themes, you know, personal struggles and emotional turmoil. Obviously, you know, the heartbreak, but also, you know, there's some thrown in there about the media and, you know, the way she's portrayed in it. And then there's lots of talk about drugs, which is interesting. And I've heard some people say that it's meant to be more like symbolic than literal. Yeah, well, let's hear a little more. This is a song called Flowrida. No, it's Florida. I've got some regrets, I'll bury them in Florida. Tell me I'm
despicable, say it's unforgivable. So yeah, Florida, sort of a southern gothic, you know, it's a power ballad, and Florence Welch of Florence and the Machine is featured on the song. You can hear her vocals there.
Yeah.
It explores themes of heartbreak and escapism, using Florida as a metaphor for emotional release and reinvention. Swift and Welch sort of intertwine their vocals throughout. They have the jarring drums of Florence and the Machine sound. I kind of like that sound.
Yeah, me too.
On this record, it especially with like 1,000 tracks, this shook things up a little bit. Yeah, so Welch dives into this dark metaphorical territory of burying past lovers in the swamps of Florida. And the lyric, "The hurricane with my name when it came," adds a personal touch, you know, Hurricane Florence.
Well, that's right.
And then in this one, Swift does describe Florida as a drug she craves to forget her pain. So
I like the one line, "The city reeks of driving myself crazy."
Yeah, that's a good one too. Yeah, so the clickbait headline I came up with, well, I didn't really know what to think of this, right? So I asked ChatGPT from the perspective of a snarky Swifty to give me a clickbait headline. Taylor Swift's The Tortured Poets Department, because even legends need a therapy session to spill their juiciest heartbreaks and redemption.
Well done, ChatGPT.
Yeah, I think that sums it up all right. You know, I'm not an expert. I'm not a fan per se. I don't have anything against her. And like we talked about with Midnights, it's the same kind of vibe where I get it and I understand why people are drawn to it. Why don't we hear a little bit more from Jess and get a perspective of someone that knows what they're talking about.
Using power of the lyrics in free verse songwriting, these are the tracks I recommend. Track 5, So Long, London.
I like that one.
The way she phrases it as a farewell to Joe Alwyn and a place she felt at ease is so creative. It's my overall favorite out of the anthology's both parts. The manuscript ends the anthology on track 31, just containing a melancholy piano played by Aaron Dessner. Hearing Taylor Swift singing, "The story isn't mine anymore," has two meanings: leaving behind the history with Joe and no longer keeping it a secret. Anthology's track 15, The Alchemy, and track 22's So High School are where Taylor's heart lies now with boyfriend Travis Kelce, seeing him win the Super Bowl this year and feeling like a teenager whenever they're together. The European's Eras Tour and multiple re-releases of the album has earned 15 separate weeks atop of Billboard's 200 chart. Just amazing how Taylor Swift's career blossomed in country, crossed over to pop, alternative, and a little bit of electronic. If you like the Tortured Poets Department, I recommend going back to her 2012 album Red, 2014's 1989, and 2017's Reputation. Thanks a lot, album nerds. Talk to you later.
Thank you, Jess. You bailed us out.
Yeah. Yeah, you should definitely check out Music Notes with Jess. I mean, she focuses on a lot of area that we're probably weak on. So a lot of like your modern hits and pop. I gotta say, like, I'm glad young people are listening to this. You know, I think they could be doing so much worse, and to have somebody that's thoughtful, that's speaking to them, you know, I think is nice.
She seems to put in the effort to do high quality work, whatever my judgment is, doesn't matter, but not just phoning it in to cash in. I don't think she needs to do that at this point.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I wouldn't call it a challenging album. It's only challenging because of its length.
In length.
Yeah. But it is, I don't know. I mean, it's moving at times, and, you know, it's, I think it's real artistic expression. So if you want a modern demonstration of intimate and introspective lyrics, you should check out Taylor Swift's The Tortured Poets Department, and go for the full thing. Go for the anthology, the 31 tracks.
All right, before Don asks us a deep question, let's hear from the Rock Talk Studio.
What was the last really great rock and roll book you read? How about a good rock and roll documentary? Well, that's why I started the Rock Talk Studio podcast, the place to go for recommendations of new rock and roll books and documentaries. Give me 20 minutes and the Rock Talk Studio podcast will get you caught up on the world of rock and roll books and docs from every possible angle and leave you with a no-doubt decision on where to spend your time and money. Want to know what to read next or which film to add to your watch list? Well, here comes all the top recommendations and hidden gems you don't want to miss. I'm your host, Big Rick. Join me for an exclusive look into what's hitting the shelves and the screens and get ready to rock your reading and viewing list. The Rock Talk Studio podcast. Your ultimate guide to discovering the best new rock and roll books and documentaries.
Yeah, I actually have to check out one he talked about. There's one about the Stone Pony, you know, that club in Jersey where Springsteen and Van Zandt and all those guys were hanging out.
Bon Jovi.
Yep.
Cool. Thanks, Rick. So if you get a minute, go check out the Rock Talk Studio podcast.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Yes, it is indeed that time again where we go deep. Deep questions by Don. All right, so we're talking about the power of lyrics, right, and great lyrics. Mm-hmm. What are some fun parodies of great lyrics?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Weird Al comes to mind, but I'll leave that to you. You're more of a Weird Al guy. I had my moments when I was in middle school, but I what popped in my head was like meaningful lyrics of Bruce Springsteen, the Boss, Born in the USA, you know, and just the whole story behind Vietnam and what it did to America. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking of Cheech and Chong's Born in East LA. I was
born which could be profound in its own way. Right?
Yeah. Took a walk to the corner store just to buy a loaf of bread and a box of s'mores. Up pulled a guy in a yellow van, shiny gold badge flashing in his hand. So yeah, it's a different, you know, it's there's still some social commentary going on there with what Cheech may have been experiencing in the streets of East LA. But there's a movie called Born in East LA that this was a part of. So that's just what came to mind. I mean, you could think about Beat It and Eat It. There's not a whole lot there, but I thought there was a little bit of meat on this parody. Yep. So go check that out if you hadn't heard it.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, Weird Al is kind of the king of song parody. It's probably not his most famous, but you know, the song I Think We're Alone, or I Think We're Alone Now.
Yeah.
And so he did it like because Tiffany had recently redone the song.
It was a cover of a Tommy James and the Shondells or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's right. So he did I Think I'm a Clone Now, which is not his best lyric, but there's a line in the song, every chromosome is a hand-me-down. Yeah, I remember that. I think that's my favorite. But if you want to see a really terrible one, there's, do you remember the song Amadeus by Falco? Amadeus, yes. Amadeus. Look up, just Google Kenny Hollywood, Eat Me, I'm a Danish. Oh, God. It's so terrible. All right, well, what's your favorite song parody? Let us know on Instagram and Facebook, or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
When I think about powerful lyrics, I think about songs normally about peace and love and junk like that, you know, from the late 60s, early 70s. So what popped in my head was John Lennon's Imagine. John Lennon, revolutionary artist and lyricist whose work transcended the boundaries of popular music and culture. Co-founder of the Beatles, his songwriting redefined the possibilities of rock and pop, and his solo career further showcased his depth as a poet. Lyrics that often were more about, you know, peace, personal introspection, and social critique. He was just a super influential voice, right? Mm-hmm. So his 1971 solo album, Imagine, his second solo, if you count the first album with the Plastic Ono Band, mm-hmm. which I do. It's iconic mostly for its title track, Imagine. Why don't we jump into that one and talk about the record? So, power of lyrics, check. I nailed it.
You did. Well, you know, it's very straightforward.
Yes.
Or, you know, kind of literal, the lyrics, you know.
Yeah, but in this particular, there are songs on this album that are about him and his personal relationships, right? Mm. It's not unlike Taylor Swift, but this one is more of a, you know, daydream. Mm. Wouldn't it be nice sort of situation where there's this utopian vision of a world without borders, religion, possessions, and all that stuff that's what divides people. What divides people is human nature. Civilization is part of what helps us control those urges. Mm. So doing away with all the convention of civilization, I don't think is the solution, but we should all be thinking about it. And he was thinking about it, and he told us what he thought might be the solution. So I think this song should spark more of a conversation where people talk about what they think and not go, well, John Lennon said, get rid of religion. Mm. You know, and I think that's what's kind of happened with it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know?
But the music, I think, just frames the lyrics so well. You know, I mean, you talked about it being sort of like a utopian dream or something. And I don't know, the music kind of gives it that dreamy feel. It's pretty sparse, but there's like those strings that just make it feel just dramatic and sad, too.
Well, it seems like a hopeless dream. Like, kind of like, this is what I dream. And you may say I'm a dreamer. I hope, you know, I'm not the only one, but I hope someday you'll join us. So that we can make this happen, because I feel like no one's listening. You know, it's kind of, that's what it kind of felt like. You know, and the album as a whole, produced by John and Yoko with Phil Spector, as much of a disappointment Phil Spector turned out to be as a human being later in his life, I think it really worked. Like, he wouldn't have thought so, but I think this was sort of his second coming of important music in his career. As you know, the stuff, the Phil Spector wall of sound that happened in the 60s with a lot of the girl groups, I think he kind of fell into the gaps, and this was his calling for this little period of time.
Yeah, I'd like to know more about the dynamic between Lennon and Spector. Like, you know, who was the bully in the studio?
John did what he wanted. He took what he wanted, did what he wanted. And I think that's why it worked, because he had the power to be like, Phil, you want to be on this project? You back up. Why don't we get into another track with some pretty powerful lyrics? This one is called Jealous Guy. So this song shows more of the vulnerable side of Lennon. Like, you know, on the previous album, they did, him and Yoko did the Primal Scream therapy. He had a lot of childhood trauma that he was dealing with that caused him to have a lot of pent-up anger. And I guess the song ended up being about moments when he takes that anger out on the people he loves. I think Yoko is in that camp, possibly even his first wife, Cynthia. And he didn't want to be that guy. He didn't want to feel rage and jealousy. He wanted to be a loving husband, especially to Yoko. And I can hear it in his voice. Mm-hmm. The just a jealous guy lyric has been kind of flagged as like he's dismissing it, saying, I'm just a jealous guy, deal with it. But I don't think that's what he was saying. I think he was trying to explain himself the best way he knew how. And just like Taylor Swift, the audience, the lovers of John Lennon and the Beatles at this time in particular, this was getting to know John. This was, you know, that mm-hmm. connection for the listeners to understand who he is as a person.
Yeah, I think when John Lennon is at his best, you know, is when he's really vulnerable like that and honest.
And introspection and clarity of lyric is what a lot of this album has, which I think is important. So that gets me to my clickbait headline. Imagine John Lennon's lyrics become meaningful windows into who he is and what he wants to be. leaving behind Goo Goo Gajub. Now, as much as I enjoy the Beatles, the later albums, the most creative ones, many of his lyrics felt dismissive. I think he just liked creating music mm-hmm. and then putting sounds to it. Like,
yeah.
I'm the walrus and things of that nature. Yeah. Just
it's kind of like sound poetry or something.
Yeah. It's artistic, but it's not lyrical connective tissue. And I feel like this album is chock full of that.
Mean Mr. Mustard sleeps in the, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's fun.
Yeah.
But this is more real.
You know, I'm just a guy, man, who writes songs.
All right. Why don't we get to what might be an early example of a diss track? This one's called How Do You Sleep?
So, of course, those are mentions of McCartney compositions. Of course, Yesterday, and then like his early solo single, Just Another Day. So, yeah, so this is actually kind of a response to some slights McCartney might have made on his first solo album, Ram.
Yeah.
The song Too Many People. I can't remember exactly what the issue was with that. But I also know at the same time, he and McCartney and Linda were like running ads in the trades, and they were like dressed like clowns, and they were wrapped in a bag, which was like a parody.
A take on the Two Virgins release from Yoko and John, where they were naked on the album cover.
Yeah. And I know, I mean, just because Yesterday was such a famous song for the Beatles, I think people would, you know, tell him, oh, Yesterday is my favorite song. And I think that probably drove him crazy.
Well, you know, what's worse, though? I mean, so they have this beef, right?
Yeah.
Understandable. And I think probably more blown out of proportion than it really was. I think that this was written in a moment. This wasn't indicative of how they felt about each other mm-hmm. overall. They loved each other. But George Harrison plays the really sweet bluesy guitar on here. So is George siding with John on this one?
Good question. But yeah, I mean, you know, beyond the lyrics of the song, I mean, I think it's one of the more effective tracks on the album.
Mm-hmm. I just love the sound of it.
Yeah. All right. Well, my clickbait headline for Imagine is Lennon balances his wit and worldview with his populist songwriting. I think I read a quote somewhere where he said he learned to serve his ideas with like a spoonful of sugar or something. Mm-hmm. So I think he kind of said that about Imagine, and then the Happy Christmas War is Over.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we know he's a great songwriter. You know, he can write a catchy tune. And I think whereas like on Plastic Ono Band, it was much rawer and less accessible. And I think here he's kind of going back to that melodic songwriting, but still, you know, packing a punch with both personal and kind of political and social ideas.
There are songs that talk about not going to war and, you know, your typical, what you would expect as we were spiraling out of the 60s and into the, you know, the hippies growing up time period.
Yeah. There's a couple of underrated parts on the album, like Crippled Inside, just mm-hmm. a very like kind of standard silly song. Oh, you know, you can put on a suit, you can put on a nice haircut or something like that, but mm-hmm. none of that helps if you're crippled inside. And so just the idea of being crippled inside is really dark and sad, you know.
But that song How, it comes right after How Do You Sleep at Night, where he's then questioning himself, mm-hmm. how he can love, how he can, you know, live, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot to unpack in a tiny little package here. But then there's songs like Oh My Love, co-written by Yoko, that introspective mm-hmm. moment, a delicate love song with the serene piano and gentle vocals, as well as Oh Yoko, the closing track. It just sounds fun and upbeat, like he's going to, after all this heaviness through the album, he's going to be okay, they're mm-hmm. going to be okay, and it's a nice closer. One thing I ran across was that copies of Imagine on LP included a postcard of John Lennon holding, like there's a pig, he's holding its ears, a playful jab at McCartney's Ram album cover where he's holding onto Ram's horns. So I looked at my copy of Imagine and a postcard was in there, man. I found it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So that was fun.
Very cool. How do you feel about him like calling Yoko by name in songs? Like, you notice like Taylor Swift changes the names of the characters in her life. And, you know, I don't know if by being so specific, if he's kind of alienating people, you know, making the songs less universal or something.
I think he was responding to people being cruel.
Yeah.
He was standing by his woman. People said a lot of mean things about her, about her race. And so there was a lot of racist stuff, a lot of, she broke up the Beatles. So I think him continuing to bring her name into it was a way to say, fuck off. I love this woman and I want to sing about love and I'm singing about her and you can deal with it. That's what I think.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point.
It's probably my favorite of his solo albums. It's a landmark album that blends his introspective lyrics and social commentary. The lyrics of the album are what give it its enduring power for me.
True.
Lennon uses his words to express both hope and disillusionment, which I think we all feel. And I hope anyone that hasn't listened to the whole thing goes and checks it out and get a little taste beyond Imagine.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
So we've been immersing ourselves in poetry from the early 1970s as well as the year 2024. What else are you digging?
Okay, so I am digging, well, as the fanboy on the show of Mac Leephart, I'm digging Motel Breakfast, his album that was just released last week, showcasing his genuine enjoyment and mastery of the country Americana music scene, continuing the charm of his previous release. Why don't we check out a little bit of Pony Montana?
What's going on in Pony? 'Cause I'm only a day or two.
What he said about this one was, by the end of the day, he kind of figured if they wrote a song about a little town with a great bar, that they might actually spin that song in that bar, and that would be something cool. I love this guy. He had heard about the town Pony Montana and just thought it sounded like a great song, right? So the album's a blend of honky-tonk, rock and roll, a lot of John Prine vibes in there. He even references him on the track Belly Full of Peaches. And Motel Breakfast is just about the traveling life and staying in motels and looking forward to that breakfast. That
I love breakfast. Motel and hotel breakfasts. You know? Even if it's just continental, you know, that big juicy muffin.
Yeah. Yikes. This guy's just so relatable. I think he's a talent that needs more attention. So go check out Mac Leephart's Motel Breakfast and his other records as well. Going throughout this week of all this introspective lyrics and sort of soft sounding music, I was driving home from running some errands and put on the radio and I heard some Stone Temple Pilots and it got me wanting to come home and listen to one of my records, the second album by them called Purple. Why don't we listen to a little bit of Vaseline?
One time a thing occurred to me, what's real, what's for
so yeah, the final copy of this I got is a limited edition reissue. It's blue with white splatter on the vinyl.
How is it not purple?
I know. The album's a dynamic fusion of grunge and alternative rock and showcases their kind of evolving sound. Lyrics are avant-garde, let's say, but it's really hooky and it's got a great balance of riffs and acoustic elements. Core's my favorite, but Purple's a close second. And Don does a great interstate love song karaoke. I've heard it myself.
Leaving on a southern train only yesterday.
Okay. I feel like you want me to stop.
I do. What are you digging, my friend?
Well, I wanted to shout out to a listener.
Yeah.
Nancy Grandit Sabatini. She's a licensed mental health therapist. She wrote a book called Song Therapeutics and Playlists to Empower Your Life. You know, so because we were talking about the power of lyrics today, you know, here it's, you know, really being harnessed for mental health. So like each chapter offers a playlist that addresses a particular life skill. So for example, on a playlist for anxiety and depression, there's Coldplay's Fix You.
Cool. That's a really fun idea.
Yeah. And so you can find it at Amazon or anywhere you buy books. It's called Song Therapeutics and Playlists to Empower Your Life. Another thing I'm digging so far is a new song by the band Haircut 100. Do you remember these guys?
I remember the name, but I can't place their hits.
I mean, they were on MTV in the old days. Probably the one you might know is Love Plus One. So they're going to come out with an album, the first one in over 40 years. There's no title yet for the album. There's a song called The Unloving Plum.
Yeah, basically, if you hear a song that sounds like it could be on the soundtrack to The Breakfast Club, Don likes it.
Good point. good point. But yeah, you know, I hadn't paid attention to these guys, but I heard them mentioned on the New Wave Music podcast, and they seem like a pretty interesting band, so kind of checking them out lately.
Cool.
All right, well, what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's the time on the show when I'm reminded of the quote by Professor Albus Dumbledore in J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter series. Words are... No, I'm not going to do that. Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it. With that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, the Wadbot, and see what we'll be discovering next week.
Your thirst for musical discovery will be taking you on a journey through time. You must explore albums from the year 1984. There is, however, a twist. You must choose from the top 10 albums of that year. Best of luck, gentlemen.
1984? Sweet.
Ooh.
I think I already know my pick. It's right there in the topic. We'll see. Don't forget, you can suggest topics for The Wheel on our website, albumnerds.com, as well as vote on any ongoing Album Nerds Hall of Fame nominations.
What's your favorite album from 1984? Who's your favorite lyricist? What else are you listening to? Leave a comment on our website or email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Album Nerds. And also, please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to support the show, you can also do so via PayPal at albumnerds.com/support.
Thank you so much for joining us here at the Album Nerds Podcast. We'll catch you next time. We'll be wearing cutoff sweatshirts and leg warmers.
I met him in a swamp down in Dagobah, where it bubbles all the time like a giant carbonated soda.
Yeah. Stupid. All right.
Shouldn't open that rabbit hole.
No, that was a mistake.